We are going for liftoff in T-30.
This is the AstroPod, a podcast from Cambridge University and inthesky.org.
Hello and welcome to the first in a new series of the AstroPod, the space science podcast from the Institute of Astronomy and Kavli Institute of Cosmology here in Cambridge. Each month we'll be speaking to some of the experts here in Cambridge and further afield to bring you all the latest news from the fields of astronomy, astrophysics and cosmology. My name is Dominic Ford and joining me this month is Nicole Pavelek.
Hello! In this month's podcast, just how special is the solar system? To find out, I'll be talking to exoplanet specialist Amy Bonser about whether other stars have rocky planets like our own Earth. Plus, we'll be hearing about the gamma ray burst, which continued to spew out gamma rays for 10 hours, when most fade in 10 seconds. And the paper which is causing headaches for cosmologists.
So if the universe is not flat, this might mean we have to rethink our main theories about the Big Bang.
Bringing you the latest news from the world of astronomy, you're listening to the AstroPod.
But first, an astronomical object you don't need any kind of telescope to see. In fact, it's usually the 11th brightest star in the sky. Any guesses? Well, I'll give you a couple of clues. This star is so famous that it's had a film named after it. And if you're a Douglas Adams fan, maybe you'll know that Four Prefects' home planet is said to be in its vicinity. Still stuck? Well, just lately, astronomers around the world have been reporting that this particular object appears much fainter than usual. So, to reveal all, here's Carlos Gonzalez.
I bring you Betelgeuse. And you know Betelgeuse because it's part of one of the few, at least for me, constellations that actually looks like the thing it's supposed to look like. This is Orion, which is supposed to look like a person. And Betelgeuse is the right shoulder of Orion. And it's a very bright, very red star. So it's very easy to pick up in the night sky.
So what's Betelgeuse been up to?
So Betelgeuse, more than up, is what Betelgeuse has been down to. So it's becoming fainter. In the last year, the energy Betelgeuse radiates has halved. So it now is about a magnitude dimmer. We astronomers talk about magnitudes, which is an awful unit because it's the logarithm of the actual energy of the flux. That means that if you are one magnitude below, your light output is halved, more or less.
So we think of the stars of the night sky as being relatively constant. Is it surprising for a star to change that much?
No, quite a few of them are actually what we call variables, stars that change in brightness, more or less dramatically. The Sun, to some extent, also changes in brightness. It's much, much less dramatic than Betelgeuse, thankfully. But we have this thing called the solar constant, which is actually not a constant. It's the kind of like energy that radiates from the Sun into the Earth, and this changes with time. So it's the same for Betelgeuse, but at a much bigger scale.
And why is Betelgeuse so very variable?
Because it is a kind of star that is called a red supergiant, and this is a very massive star that is at least 10 times the mass of the Sun, and it's kind of like in the last stages of its life. It's kind of like about to move to Costa del Sol and retire there. So it has already moved from what we call the main sequence, which is kind of like where most of the stars spend their life. They are burning hydrogen in their cores and making helium out of hydrogen, like the Sun is doing at the moment. But Betelgeuse has already consumed all its hydrogen that it had on the core of the star. And now is actually burning helium, which is the next phase of the kind of like stellar evolution of this star. And this comes with a lot of instability. It's not as smooth as the Sun. So, you know, the star expands and contracts and like, because it's very massive, it's very bright. And this implies that part of these outer layers are being spilled. It's so bright and so big that it cannot hold its own material. So it's pushing things out. It's a very complex physical environment in this star.
Now, a lot of people have been speculating about whether this fade might indicate that Betelgeuse was about to go supernova. Why would a fade indicate it might go supernova?
In reality, the thing here is that we know all red supergiants are going to go out with a supernova event. But the problem with supernovae is that studying a supernova is like finding a needle on a haystack, but the other way around. Somebody gives you the needle and you have to locate the haystack. So you find the supernova, which is something extremely bright and impossible to miss in the sky. But then once the supernova has faded, you have to figure out which star was the one that actually went supernova. Now with Betelgeuse, because we know it's a red supergiant, we know it's going to go supernova. But we don't know how does a star look when it's about to go supernova. The only thing that we know is that Betelgeuse will become a supernova and Betelgeuse is doing something funny at the moment. This is the only things we know. And it's very, very likely that, well, in all likelihood, Betelgeuse is not going to explode in probably our lifetime. Probably we are talking about 100,000 years. That's what it will take Betelgeuse to actually explode.
If it did go supernova, should we humans be worried about the radiation that would produce?
Not very much, really. So Betelgeuse is about 700 light years away. So even if it goes supernova, and it will be very bright, it will be probably brighter than the full moon. So we will even be able to see Betelgeuse by day, for example. But we shouldn't be worried about it. And this has happened before. We have historical records of, I think, mostly Chinese astronomers that have recorded other supernovae going off. And because this is something extremely spectacular, when you see, you know, one star that suddenly you can see by day. And nothing has happened before, so we shouldn't be worried.
And if Betelgeuse does go supernova, I guess that would be a wonderful way to explore the physics of how supernovae happen.
Yeah, because we will be able to see this as it happens. We will be able to see how the star behaves, years before the supernova event. The way stars work is that they go through phases. And the closer these phases are to the end of their life, the faster they go. So for example, a star like Betelgeuse will spend tens of millions of years in their main sequence, burning hydrogen. Then they will spend hundreds of thousands of years burning helium. Then they will spend hundreds of years burning carbon. Then years burning, I think it's oxygen. And then these things speed up, and the latest phases lasts hours and minutes. And it is impossible or extremely, extremely hard to study this otherwise.
That was Carlos Gonzalez, who works here at the Institute of Astronomy.
This is the AstroPod. Follow us on Twitter at @Cambridge_Astro.
Earlier this month, the Institute of Astronomy hosted a meeting of planetary scientists, exoplanet hunters, and geologists to discuss the science of rocky planets. This was one of the first times such a diverse group of scientists had come together. Recent discoveries by exoplanet missions mean that for the first time, scientists studying our own solar system and planets elsewhere in the universe can start to piece together a coherent understanding of the formation and evolution of planets, like our own Earth. To find out more, I caught up with the meeting's organizer, Amy Bonsor.
Okay, so this was the Rocky Worlds meeting. So we're interested in rocky planets and how rocky planets are formed, what's in the interiors of rocky planets, and we also talked about the atmospheres of these rocky planets.
What is a rocky planet?
A rocky planet is a planet like our Earth that's mainly composed of rocks, as in hard stones that make up a planet like Earth or like Venus or like Mars. And we're interested in looking forward to the next kind of 20 years when we start to detect lots and lots of these planets around stars other than our sun.
So you mentioned Mars and Venus. Were you talking about our solar system as well?
Yeah, so part of the point of this meeting was to really bridge the gap between what we know about our solar system and how we can use that to learn about the planets that we are finding and hope to find around stars other than our sun.
Okay, so did you find rocky worlds around other stars?
As yet, we have maybe a dozen or so planets that might be defined as rocky that we've detected, for example, using the transit detection method, where we look for a dip in the light from a nearby star that tells us a planet's passed in front of it.
Let's come back a little bit to the solar system. So you mentioned Mars and Venus. Were there nice talks about Mars and Venus at the conference?
Yes, absolutely. So we talked a lot about Venus, and one of the big open questions is, how is Venus different from Earth? Why do we have life on Earth, and yet we don't, as far as we're aware, have life developing on Venus? And how does that discrepancy between these two relatively similar planets potentially pay out in the case of planets around other stars?
Why is Venus similar to Earth?
So Venus has the same size approximately and the same mass as Earth. So when we look at another planetary system, if we're saying this is an exo-Earth, it's a planet that looks like Earth, it has an Earth mass, an Earth radius, and temperature about the same as Earth. Well, Venus actually fits all three of those, and yet we know it's a radically different planet to our own planet Earth.
Why is Venus different from Earth?
So Venus has a very thick atmosphere and a runaway greenhouse effect. That means that it's much, much hotter surface temperatures than Earth. So there's no liquid water, for example.
Okay, so how is it different from Mars, for example?
So Mars is much cooler, has a much less atmosphere. And we think that at some point there is evidence, at least on the surface of Mars, that there was at some point the effect of water in the rock record.
You mentioned that Mars is different from Earth. It has no atmosphere or no significant atmosphere. And they are looking for water on Mars. So where did the water on Mars go if it were there?
So the evidence from the Martian surface that there was once water there comes from rocks that look like they have the geology of having been affected by weathering processes involving water. So John Maid gave a very exciting talk to start the conference where he talked about the fact that a potential difference in where the water happened on Earth compared to Mars could result from how water behaves when it goes into rocks. So he suggests that for Mars, if the water enters into the rocks and they become hydrated species, that the Martian crust has different properties to Earth's crust. So at the point when it's hydrated, this can be subducted underneath, such that the water that was present on Mars's surface early in its evolution could now be present interior to the Martian surface where we can no longer see it. For Earth, the opposite happens, whereby hydrated rocks mean that the crust is lighter and it floats on top of this magma ocean, hence we still have lots of water on the surface of Earth.
Is this an open question, or could the water have just vanished?
I think what happened to water on Mars is very much an open question, and the work of John Wade is making the point that there are alternative solutions out there and different ways for us to be able to explain this.
Would we expect, or can we observe water on exoplanets?
So we have two ways of accessing the potential for there to be water on a planet around a star other than our sun. One of those ways is to look at the density of that planet and use that to estimate that we have a substantial fraction of water within that planet, known as water worlds. The other way is to look in the atmosphere of an exoplanet, and sometimes we're able to get these spectral signatures that there is water vapor present in that atmosphere.
What do we know about rocky worlds so far, and what is the future plan?
So we're really on the cusp of understanding and detecting planets that are like our own Earth. We've got to the point where we've found a dozen or so planets which could be classified as being kind of Earth-like. And in the next 20 years, these are going to be detected commonplace, particularly as missions such as Plato come on board, that will detect lots of planets around stars other than the sun, including very small rocky planets.
What is about this new space telescope, JWST?
So JWST is the James Webb Space Telescope, and it's going to be able to do a lot of amazing science for a lot of different fields. One of the really cool things that it'll be able to do for rocky planets is that it'll be able to start to probe the atmospheres of these planets. So this is something that's been ongoing for the last 10, 15 years for hot, big gas giants around other stars, where we can start to see emission features from their atmospheres. JWST will be able to repeat some of this science, but moving down to much, much smaller planets that are more like Earth.
Will there be other telescopes observing exoplanets and especially rocky worlds?
Plato is a very important mission that will be looking at lots of rocky worlds. The Ariel mission will start to look for atmospheres of both gas giants and rocky planets.
A nice question which a lot of people are interested in is, might we be able to find life on these exoplanets? What might be criteria for that?
So that's something that astronomers are very interested in as well. And in particular, astronomers tend to look for planets in something that we call the habitable zone. So these are planets that have the same kind of conditions that you need to get liquid water on Earth. So they have the same moderate temperatures that we have on Earth, and we look for planets that are similar mass and radii to Earth. But we talked at the meeting a lot about other signatures that might exist for habitability, including biosignatures, so signatures for species of gas that you can see in planets' atmospheres that tell us about life. And one of the interesting things about these is that a lot of these signatures that could plausibly tell us about the existence of life could also be produced in certain conditions abiotically, and that means without the presence of life due to geological processes.
What about Venus and Mars, for example? Are they in the habitable zone of our solar system as well as Earth?
Yeah, absolutely. Both of them are very close to this habitable zone. And that's one of the reasons why we need further distinguishing factors. Having a planet which has the same kind of temperature as Earth, the same mass and the radius, doesn't tell us that it has developed in the same way. It doesn't tell us anything about the surface conditions or the conditions in the atmosphere of that planet that might lead to the presence of life.
So what are future prospects of detecting life on exoplanets?
So I think most of these focus on biosignatures, these signatures of gases in the atmospheres of these planets that we think are related to biological processes. And there are many of these signatures which plausibly could be related to the presence of life, but actually, in order to really ascertain whether or not a planet has life, we have to really understand what it is about our own planet Earth that led to the origin of life. And that's why there's a lot of active research in understanding the origin of life on Earth as well.
That was Amy Bonzer talking there to Nicole about the Rocky Worlds meeting here at the Institute of Astronomy earlier this month. And we'd particularly like to thank the Kavli Institute, who provided the funding for that meeting.
You're listening to the AstroPod.
The voice there of the amazing Kate Lamble off the BBC's World Service, who was so kind that she recorded all of our voiceovers and asked for just one potted plant in payment for her trouble. The trouble is, I'm not much of a botanist and I'm not sure what kind of plant to buy her. So if you've got any suggestions or if you've got any feedback or questions you'd like to ask the AstroPod, please do get in touch. You can email us on astropod@ast.cam.ac.uk. And as Kate said, this is the AstroPod with me, Dominic Ford.
And with me, Nicole Pavelek. Now it's time to move up to much larger scales. In fact, just about the largest length scales in the universe. We're about to imagine you climbed into a spaceship and flew right across the universe in a straight line. The question is, might the universe ever wrap around onto itself like a globe of the world, so you found yourself back where you started? Or would you go on forever finding more galaxies? Well, maybe that all sounds like science fiction, but as Sunny Vagnozzi told Dominic, it's a serious question for cosmologists.
So, there's been a very interesting debate in the past 3 months as to whether we might have gotten the shape of the universe all wrong. Now, what do we mean by shape of the universe? The debate here is as to whether the universe is flat or closed. To picture what this means, it's best if we think about the Earth. So, if on the Earth you start up at a certain point and keep walking in a straight line, you eventually get back to the point where you started from. That's because the Earth is closed, and the same would happen in the universe if it were closed. If instead the universe is flat, you can start off at a certain point, keep working in a straight line, and never get back to the point where you started.
So in terms of the curvature of the universe, what is the significance of whether that's flat or curved?
So whether the universe is flat or curved can tell us a great deal about two important things. One is the fate of the universe, because you can imagine a closed universe in the future collapsing upon itself, essentially in what's called a big crunch, which is the opposite of the Big Bang. The second important fact is that whether the universe is closed might tell us something about the Big Bang itself. In fact, the conventional models for so-called inflation, which is what we usually refer to when we think about the Big Bang, predict that the universe should be very close to flat. So if the universe is not flat, this might mean we have to rethink our main theories about the Big Bang. So the debate has been sparked by a recent paper published in Nature Astronomy and led by Eleonora Di Valentino, a researcher at the University of Manchester. So in the past decade, a host of data from many cosmological surveys has suggested that the universe is flat to very high accuracy, whereas this new paper suggests that the universe is actually closed, so curled on itself like a ball, at a rather high statistical significance. Now, the debate is as to whether this is just a fluke or whether we should give more credit to this idea.
So do you believe it yourself?
I think we need to be cautious. I think there are grounds to believe it might just be a fluke, because it's a result which is not supported by independent probes. And I think only more data can tell.
And what are the instruments that we use to make those measurements?
We essentially use satellites. In this case, in the case of this study, the satellite is the Planck mission founded by the European Space Agency, which has produced some of the most detailed maps of the CMB to date.
And that's been working for some time, I think, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's been working for almost 10 years, but it recently produced its final results.
So what next steps could we take to work out whether this is right?
Essentially, we need more precise data, which we can anticipate from future surveys, both of the cosmic microwave background as well as surveys of galaxies.
And what missions are coming up that might do that?
So we'll have, for example, CMB missions such as Simons Observatory or CMB S4, or future galaxy surveys such as DESI, Euclid and LSST, which has recently been renamed the Vera Rubin Telescope.
That was Sunny Vagnozzi from the Kavli Institute of Cosmology here in Cambridge. And you can find the paper which sparked that debate in the November 2019 issue of Nature Astronomy by Eleonore Di Valentino and her colleagues.
The telescope that Sunny mentioned at the end, the LSST, or Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, is one that particularly excites me, as once it comes online in 2 years' time, it'll take absolutely exquisite images of the whole night sky every few days to monitor for any object that changes in brightness over time.
So no prospect then of Betelgeuse changing in brightness without the LSST noticing?
Absolutely not. But it won't just monitor bright stars like Betelgeuse. Its huge 8-meter mirror will enable it to see stars right down to what astronomers call the 25th magnitude, which means it will be able to monitor well over a billion stars. But as names go, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope is a bit of a mouthful. So just before Christmas, it was renamed the Vera Rubin Telescope, in honor of Vera Rubin, who discovered some of the first observational evidence for dark matter whilst working at the Carnegie Institution of Washington in the 1960s. It's great that Rubin's work is being given the recognition it deserves, and fitting that the first large observatory to be named after a female astrophysicist should be in honor of her. Now, sticking with the theme of astronomical objects that change in dramatic and unexpected ways, it's time to talk about gamma ray bursts. As far as we know, these are the most powerful explosions anywhere in the universe, producing bursts of radioactive particles that can be seen right across the universe. But they normally only produce energetic gamma rays for a few seconds before completely fading from view. In December, though, a paper appeared in Nature Astronomy reporting that one such object could still be detected producing gamma rays a full 10 hours after its outburst. Here's Aybüke Yoldaş with the details.
So this is the news about the discovery of very high energy emission from a gamma ray burst. Gamma ray bursts are the most energetic cosmic explosions in the universe. They basically outshine the whole universe in the gamma rays in the few seconds that they explode. And they are wonderful laboratories that combine astronomy, cosmology, and extreme physics. They were first discovered in 1967. But our knowledge on the gamma ray bursts came more with the afterglow emission discovery, which happened in 1997. The afterglow emission basically happens in all wavelengths from X-rays, optical, infrared, millimeter, and radio after the gamma ray burst itself, after the prompt emission in the gamma rays. And in this particular case, the GRB 180720b, which is by convention named after the date it occurred, the 20th of July 2018, this gamma ray burst, or in short GRB, was observed by the Fermi satellite and Swift satellite and some ground-based telescopes in Namibia, which discovered very, very high energy gamma rays during the afterglow emission, which is a first time observation. These kind of very high energy particles normally are observed from the jets of active galactic nuclei, which are very high mass black holes, so millions to billions times the mass of our sun at the center of the galaxies, whereas the long-duration gamma-ray bursts, which is the case for this GRB, are due to the collapse of massive stars, single stars, which are only 30 to 40 times the mass of our Sun. So it is really interesting to observe the same sort of energies from just a compact object, a single star, compared to the supermassive black holes at the center of the galaxies.
That was Ibuka Aldash from the Institute of Astronomy. And if you'd like to find out more about that story, you can find all the details in the December 2019 issue of Nature Astronomy, where that paper was published by Hassan Abdallah and his colleagues.
That's all for the first edition of the Astropod. But Dominic and I will be back next month with more news from the world of astronomy. In the meantime, if you like to find out more about the Astropod, you can find all the details on our website at www.public.ast.chem.ac.uk/astropod.
The Astropod is brought to you from Cambridge's Institute of Astronomy and Kavli Institute for Cosmology. If you've got any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. You can email astropod@ast.cam.ac.uk or find us on Twitter @Cambridge_astro.